Hi, this is Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Here is part two of my interview with Dave Mattson, partner of Sandler Sales Institute. And in the next hour, you're going to hear Dave field questions from my students at HardToFindSeminars.com. All questions related about sales, selling, and confidence. He hasn't prepared for these questions. He's hearing them for the first time, and I think you're going to be very impressed with some of the useful answers he gives answering questions from folks from all over the world, all related about sales. Please note, unfortunately, there was a little bit of line disturbance. You're going to hear a little bit of hissing, and I really apologize about this. I think you'll have no problem listening to the audio. Just give it some time, and you'll kind of start to ignore that background noise, and I apologize. If it's too much of a problem, you can certainly print out and read the transcripts. Give it a chance. I think you'll be fine, and you're going to really want to hear these answers, so let's get going.
Dave Mattson.
Dave, it's Mike Senoff here.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm real good. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good. Are you ready to roll this morning?
Yep.
So we're here with part two with Dave Mattson, and Dave's been generous enough to give us an hour of his time handling and fielding questions from the students from HardToFindSeminars.com. And the first question I have for you, Dave, is what qualities would you look for when you're hiring a new sales superstar? This is from John Rifstall. He's an HMA marketing consultant in Norway.
What I would look for as I'm looking for a superstar in the field, because obviously everybody's a superstar when they're looking for a job, what we're trying to ensure ourselves is that they're a superstar after they've left that interview and they're actually on your payroll. So here's what I look for. Do they have the past experience that is similar to what you would like them to do? As an example, if you want them to call on small entrepreneurs and they're used to calling on the Fortune 500, there is a disconnect there. If they're on a 7-week sales cycle and you want them to go on a 2-week sales cycle, then that's a real problem. So we use an acronym called SEARCH. SEARCH stands for S, which is skills. Are the skills that they currently bring to this interview consistent with what you want them to do at their job? E is experience. Do they have the experiences at their current workplace that is consistent with what you want them to do here? A is attitude. Do they have those attitudes? As an example, you may have people that are fighter pilots that are used to doing things on their own, and you need more of a team approach, and vice versa. You may have a team player who you would really like to go out there and do their own thing. That's a real problem since they've always relied on others to help them out. Then we have R, results. Are the results that they're bringing to the table consistent with what you want them to have? As an example, first of all, do they have the experience and skill of cold calling? And if they do, are the results within the parameters that you're looking for? So if I make 100 calls and I typically get 1 or 2 appointments, and I know that to be successful here as an HMA consultant, you need a 4 to 10, 6 to 10, 8 to 10. Well, then I have to look back and say, is it a training issue? Do I have enough prospects for this person to deal with? What is it? And then H is for habits. Do they have the habits that are necessary to succeed? So that's what I would call a starting point, and then you can develop your questions that revolve around, hey, do they have those skills, the experiences, the results, the habits that would be consistent? And C, which I forgot, C is cognitive skills. So they have processes in place that would be consistent with a top producer in your industry. Don't look at the person to say, hey, did they influence me? Did I feel comfortable? Because we tend to, as you've read in every other book, we hire mirror reflections of ourselves. That may be good or bad, but you have a lot of company knowledge and product knowledge as the person interviewing that that person doesn't benefit from. So I would look for, do they match up their past world with what I'm looking for them to do in the future? Because past success dictates future success. That's the key.
Perfect. Thank you. Dave, some of my clients are financial planners. They are very hesitant to do anything too salesy, quote. I need to sell them on asking for referrals and doing more cross-selling. Any suggestions on sales for professionals? This is from Richard Emmons, an HMA consultant in Grant Pass, Oregon.
Well, cross-selling is always an interesting topic, always raised within our own programs. You know, we have a program called Sales Strategies for the Non-Selling Professional, and those are either for technical people or people that don't want to be perceived as a salesperson. So as a financial planner, you want to be a quote-unquote consultant, not somebody be hawking a different product or service. That's the fine line. So what do we do? There's a difference between a vendor and a trusted advisor. As a financial planner, we're striving to be that trusted advisor. Now, whether you go to a doctor, as an example, you want the doctor to say, hey, you should go to have these tests done. You should really think about taking this prescription or these vitamins. You don't say, well, hey, doc, are you going to get kickback from the MRI group over here? No, because they have that relationship. So I think that if you're questioning whether do I have the ability, do I have the right as a consultant, as an advisor to bring up other products or services, then you first thing you have to do is step back and question what is the true relationship that you have with your current customers. Is it a vendor if you're selling a particular product or service, or is it more of an advisor? If it's an advisor, here's what I would do. You look at the current portfolio. You then figure out where the holes are. You may or may not be able to fill those holes with your product or service, but it is your responsibility to tell that customer, here are the holes. I can take care of them with these three holes with my product or service, but you still have two additional holes left, in my opinion. You should go do something about that. And by the way, here are some recommendations on who you could go to get that done. That's an unbiased situation. I would do that all day long. Listen, buyer psychology dictates people want to buy from people who they have a relationship with. They want to buy additional products and services from you. Think about buyer anxiety. It increases when they have to go find another vendor, another person to go buy a particular product or service from, where either A, you could have recommended it, or B, you could have sold it. So you're allowing a competitor to get into your client base, which is a serious mistake. But more importantly, you're putting your existing customer through a whole decision process they don't really have to go through. You could have done that and, quite frankly, lowered their anxiety, increased their customer satisfaction with you, and had a customer for life. So it is your responsibility to make them aware of the issue and to come with solutions. So I wouldn't look at it as a salesperson. I would look at it as someone who's doing their job properly. The flip side is you don't want a customer to come and say to you, Mike, hey, why didn't you tell me? And if you said, well, I didn't tell you that, Dave, because I didn't want to be a salesperson, I would say, well, that's your job. Your job doesn't necessarily have to push me over the cliff to buy, but your job is to certainly expose me to the issue, give me solutions, and tell me what you would have done. That's what a financial planner is. Plan the future. Don't plan a particular call.
Awesome. This is a question from Brandon Wilkins. Dave, I'm looking to start my own business venture as a marketing consultant, helping other businesses to grow and intensify their marketing efforts. I have done fax and email blast of my initial sales letter, but have received no responses. I've also asked for referrals from current business people I know, and in quotes, they're not company owners, decision makers, just employees. Do you have any suggestions of initiating a grassroots method to get those first few clients?
It's always difficult because I think when you don't have those first clients, Brandon, then even your own conviction, you start to question whether you're doing the right thing and you have the right message. The letter, that's okay. I call that a passive approach. You know, you don't know who is going to respond. You need to come up with what I'm going to call a prospecting plan. So if you know you need 20 conversations, as an example, come up with a list of all the areas that could feed into the 20 people that you need to talk to. It could be, you know, I'm going to blast email my letter and I expect one out of that. I'm going to go to an association meeting. I expect two out of that. I plan on talking in front of a small entrepreneur group and I expect 10. I know from our group, there's probably 24 ways that we go to market. We have our trainers pick 2 or 3 that are really philosophically in line with what their strengths are. But whether it's an executive briefing, and Brandon, you know, there's plenty of places that entrepreneurs like myself go to meetings. You could speak about how to increase the effectiveness of your current marketing program and be a hero. And here are the top 10 things that you have to look for. You don't have to skew it to you, but you would be a content expert. You talk for 45 minutes. I know in my world, if I'm in front of 20 strangers at one of these briefings, 13 will give me an appointment, 9 will buy. So I know the numbers. So that's one thing that you should start thinking about, is to expand the scope of where they're coming from. Second thing, listen to yourself on your scripts. You may find that they're too focused on what you do and not enough focused on what the issues are that the entrepreneurs are facing. The other thing that I would do is just to get in the car, start making calls, whether it's phone calls or walk-ins, but get that done. I would also even consider a foot-in-the-door strategy. You know, when you're new as an HMA consultant, don't look around for people who are selling $5,000 projects. That's not you. You may consider a foot-in-the-door strategy that puts your ego aside for a minute and say, hey, what can I do to get my first 5 to 6 clients? I call them charter clients. That way you can feel good about it, make it easy for them to do business with you, leverage it with other clients for testimonials and referrals, and also use that as, you know, here's my foot in the door for one particular project, but you know within your portfolio you could sell 2 or 3, 4 more other projects for higher rates. So put your ego aside when you're thinking about that. Just come up with some foot in the door strategies. You also, whether it's silent auctions, every community, private schools, there's always fundraisers. I suggest that you start to give away a free marketing audit to an entrepreneur. Get your foot in the door that way. Do an audit, come back. Of course, there's going to be areas that you can help them with. That's another way to get those conversations going. But at the end of the day, take an active approach versus a passive approach. Start banging out those numbers.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Question from John Lamb. Dave, I'm an engineer, and I talk to the computer more than people. I don't know how to sell, whether it's real selling or just selling myself in an interview. Seriously, can sales skills be taught?
If it's a sales interview, which I think is what you're talking about, the answer is yes. I'm introverted by nature. I didn't grow up as a salesperson. No one in my family is a salesperson. I think it's a conviction issue and a comfort issue. I would suggest to you that you do a couple things. Say your talk out loud. If you're talking to your computer more than you talk to people, there's got to be 5 or 6 scenarios where you interact with a person. And whether it's selling an idea or selling a particular product or service that you're supporting somebody else selling, get your part out. Say it out loud 5 to 6 times. Psychology dictates, Mike, that if somebody says it out loud 6 times, A, never great the first 2 or 3 times. Don't be discouraged, but it goes into long-term memory and you don't feel as much pressure. You know, for years, I did 10 hours of prep for 1 hour of stand-up when I did seminars. And so now I'm 3 to 1, but I've been doing it for 20 years and I'm still introverted. That hasn't changed. So I think, yes, it's doable. I think you just have to start practice, feel comfortable. But more importantly, think about the service that you're doing that other person. How many times have you seen a non-engineer make a mistake because they didn't have all the technical know-how that you have? That's what you're bringing to the table. You're actually doing them a service by explaining what you do. One of the most disarming things that you could do, and again, we teach this to our engineers, is to start off by saying, you know, Mr. Prospect or Ms. Prospect, I'd like to ask you a couple questions today. You know, I got to tell you up front, I'm not a salesperson. I'm an engineer by training, and that's my specialty. So if I don't ask some questions that you think, you know, you would want me to, please feel free to jump in. But that's just not my strength. By saying that, you disarm the prospect. You also then elevated yourself because it's a very human moment. And quite frankly, you struggle. And when people struggle, you will watch. Your prospects will actually help you through the sale. I used that line for many years. Hey, I'm not a salesperson, so if I forget to bring up an important topic or I'm going too much into the detail and you've got the concept, just say, Dave, I understand it. Let's go on to something else. Just help me out. I would have people helping all day long. But what they're really doing psychologically is helping themselves buy. So given the choice between 20 salespeople and 20 engineers, who would I train to get the biggest ROI? I trained 20 engineers, so I think you're light years ahead of people who think they were born as a salesperson.
This is a question from Mike Imperial. Dave, at the beginning of a sales presentation, is it best to ask consultative questions about what the prospect is looking for before talking about yourself, company, and credentials, etc.? If not, what is the best format?
Well, you know, Mike, that's a great question. Let me answer very directly, yes. Start off by asking consultative questions. You know, if you feel uncomfortable with that because you've been brought up in features and benefits, then I would certainly start off by saying, hey, let me spend 2 minutes. I'll give you a 30,000-foot view of who we are. And then let me ask you a couple of questions if I can to get a better understanding of what the issues are. And then I can tailor some of my responses to you because some people are embedded in. They must talk about their company. I think the best thing that you can avoid is to show up at that PowerPoint and say, hey, before we start today, let me give you a little overview of our company. You turn the lights down and say, roll them. You know, it's slide deck 642 later, you get to, so what are your issues? There's a concept called primacy and recency. People always remember how you start and how you end. So start with what's important to them. It's not your company. It's my issues. People want to solve their own problems. So even in proposals, I would tell Mike to say, hey, prospect's problem. Here's my solution. As an exhibit, here's the company overview. People automatically go right to that section anyway. So it's a bonding move to say, hey, I'm certainly happy to tell you about my company. Let's start off if I could ask you a couple questions to better understand what your issues are. People will love you for it. Keep doing it if that's what you're doing. It's called you-focused selling. Focus on the buyer. Stop focusing on what's important to you personally, which may be your product, it may be your company overview. If it makes sense based on their discussion with you, you have plenty of time to weave that in. I have had companies spend large amounts of money at Sandler never asking for a company overview, never asking for testimonials or referrals, because they understood that, hey, they've explained the problem, they've understood it, and they had trust and conviction that I could deliver, and it wasn't because they talked to a referral. It's the way that you approach the sale. So yes, the consultants are selling questions.
Question from Carolyn Winslow. Dave, what are the top three motivators for sales performance with a sales force? I personally believe that in a list of 10, money is about 9. What's your opinion?
Top three motivators for Salesforce, I think, is a win. People want to win. I think it's clear direction. Give me the rules so I understand where I can play with those rules. And I also think a top motivator for them is what I'm going to call KPIs. What are the indicators for success? I motivate Salesforces all day long. There's a low-tech, high-touch approach. If you would take your KPIs and key performance indicators in your sales process, that if they did these things, as an example, one of the things that I measure is the number of first calls. And when I track that, first of all, it's very motivating for people because whether you're new or a veteran, everybody has equal footing on behaviors versus outcomes. And that's very motivating for most. It's also competitive because now we have positive competitive juices internally. So does compensation drive all behavior? Well, I think it does, but I think that the parameters more so are give me the rules to succeed, give me the parameters, give me the scenario that I absolutely need to do, give me the tools. And I think if you do those things and show them that you're paying attention to them, salespeople will leave an organization not because of money. They will leave because they're stroke deprived. You know, clients will leave you because they don't feel appreciated. So are salespeople. They will justify their departure by saying it's because I got a better deal financially, but that's not true. People will leave your organization because they don't feel appreciated and they're done learning. So constantly stretch them. Let them learn more. They will stay with you for life.
Here's a question from an actual sales trainer, a sales training firm, kind of like what you're doing, but on a smaller level. His name is Ian Siegel. Dave, what is the most effective way to follow up after having submitted a proposal, assuming you haven't been able to close at that point?
The best way to follow up is you're not available. Well, I'm assuming under this question from Ian that they were face-to-face and they delivered that proposal.
Yes.
Then under that arrangement, if you were not able to close, you should have what we call an upfront contract. An upfront contract means that you understand that the client's going to go into some super secret committee meeting and have discussions which you're not participating in, but you would like to know when would they have an answer. Okay, and they can give you that versus you calling back and being a pest. So, hey, listen, I understand that you guys have to meet internally. When do you think you'd have that done? Well, by next week. Okay, so if I called you Thursday, can we set an appointment now? That way you can give me some feedback of where you are. You may have to tell me, hey, Dave, we haven't gotten it done yet. Give me another week. But let's schedule an appointment now on the telephone that we can talk and at least give me an update of what's going on. So set it up now. Don't chase after the fact. Best thing, of course, is to set a face-to-face meeting for you to go back and talk to them face-to-face. If you can't do it, a telephone appointment is the next best thing.
Question from Al Spear of MarketingAdrenaline.com. Dave, what are some resources for finding where the prospects in your market are so that you can reach them through the most appropriate marketing methods, online or off?
Well, of course, the best thing to do is to work off referrals. But if we can't do that, we tend to use Hoovers for a lot of what we do to pick out who's who and where they are and some background. I have found that most companies use that market intelligence process, but I'm sure there's others out there. But that's the one that we use to do some due diligence. I think there's about 9 steps that we teach people to go online to figure out who's who, but to identify prospects in my marketplace. So I do accurate territory management stuff. I would go to Hoovers.
This is an anonymous question. Dave, some say that you have to be creative in sales. To what degree do you believe this to be true?
I don't believe that to be true at all, actually. I think that most successful salespeople follow systems and processes. Being creative simply gives you permission not to follow a system. You know, we have this Handler selling system. I think that engineers follow systems. Pilots follow systems. You know, you would hope your doctor follows a system. You know, you don't want a pilot of the plane to say, hey, listen, we're not going to use autopilot today. We're going to be creative. I would be very nervous. I would also be very nervous if my surgeon said that. So salespeople who are the most successful follow systems and processes. Now, creative could be interpreted as that you want to make sure that you have listening skills and you have the ability to be creative when you're weaving in your solutions to their problem. But that's the only reason that you would want to be creative, is to make sure that if it doesn't fit exactly into the box, what can you do to solve that prospect's needs within the parameters that that company has given to you. But if somebody was interviewing to me and said, hey, I'm very creative, every time I approach the sales process, you know, it's very different, I would not hire that person under any circumstances. That's a very reactive person, makes it up as they go, and quite frankly, you're never going to succeed to the levels of what professional salespeople who are very successful at what they do will ever achieve. So follow systems. Don't get creative.
Here's a question from Darren Jacklin. He's a wonderful motivational coach, and he's out of British Columbia, Canada. His website is called TrustTheProcessEvents.com. Dave, let's say that you meet someone from a foreign culture in a business meeting, and you have limited time to present your product or service. How would you establish rapport and credibility to close the deal?
Well, if I met somebody from a foreign culture, I couldn't have time to, quote-unquote, close the deal, then I would turn that into a positive, and I would simply say, let's just say it's Darren. I would say, Darren, based on what we've said thus far, I think there's a connection here. I think that we may be able to help. Let's set some time where you and I can chat one-on-one to make sure that I fully do understand the issues and that we can create a plan moving forward. How do you feel about that? Let them say yes or no. Let them lead the dance, even though they're really not leading the dance or really responding to your question. That's the best way. Quite frankly, I think that most of the selling should be done that way. When you're at the trade shows or conventions, it's very difficult to, quote unquote, close people at those. And when you are spending your energy, as Darren knows, you're spending your energy with person one, 15 people walks by. So I would always set one-on-ones after the fact. And quite frankly, you'd be better off that way anyways to get that done. You get to see more people. But certainly in the foreign culture, even if there's a language barrier, it's much easier to get yourself off-site in a quiet environment. You can focus on what you're doing. That's very positive buying perspective. So there's a lot of good things that would happen as a result of that. So that's the way I would do it.
Great. You're doing great, Dave. These are great, great answers. Dave, are there any mental or physical preparatory strategies you would suggest before making a sales call, not just over the phone, but in person as well?
Yeah, both physical and mental get ready. Well, first of all, I tend to take a couple deep breaths before I walk into a meeting. It helps me get focused on what I'm doing. Some of the mental preparation that I do is to focus on the top two or three questions that I want to make sure that I ask in the first couple minutes, because again, that primacy and recency concept kicks in. I think I want to start strong, so I want a game plan. So one of the things that I want to do is to go over the questions that I'm going to ask. I'm going to go over the potential roadblocks or red flags that would pop up, because I don't want to be surprised. I know there are some, there always are. What are they? And then when they throw them on the table, which they always do, you don't have to look shocked. You know they're there. You're confident. You know your answer. I'm a big rehearser, so I tend to rehearse. I would suggest that you do that also. But I also would say, hey, throw out your last 10 to 15 years worth of product knowledge. That's the best thing that you can do and tell yourself psychologically is it's the first day in the business. Ask some questions. Most people get very uncomfortable in the beginning because they want to establish credibility by showing off their product knowledge. The most successful people are the ones that sometimes do it by accident. What I mean by that is they ask tons of questions because they don't have the product knowledge. You know, if you've been in the industry for 25 years, you hear the first couple minutes of a question, you shut down because you know the answer, but you don't ask more questions so the prospect experiences that. So, hey, slow down, ask questions, You don't have to show your credibility through product knowledge. It's okay. And if you would tell yourself that, and then, of course, visualize what your end result is going to be. I'm asking for another meeting. I'm asking for a close. I'm asking for a beta test. Whatever it is, then I would go into that with that. I think that we tend to wing it. And more time that you spend on prep, more that you're going to close. When you're in a team sales situation or a one-on-one sales call, if that meeting is a half an hour, you should at least have 15 to 20 minutes of prep time, physically and mentally, going right through that process. I think that's something that most salespeople don't do. Certainly, the longer you've been in the business, we do it less frequently.
Question from Dwight Woods out of Miami, Florida. He's the CEO and owner of Unified Martial Arts Academy. His website is MiamiJeetKundo.com. This is the discipline of martial arts that originally was developed by Bruce Lee. I've interviewed him on my site, HardToFindSeminars.com. And if you like Bruce Lee, it's a fascinating interview that you could find up on my site. But his question is, Dave, my instinct is not to be pushy. How do I overcome this instinct when a former student or prospect says, I'm no longer interested?
Well, I think that your instincts should play true on this. For instance, I wouldn't be pushy either because they're going to expect you to be pushy. So, Dwight, if somebody says, I'm no longer interested, the minute you come back and be pushy, well, why not? You're almost there. Here's what's going to happen. Then you are pushing against their decision. So why don't we use martial arts? Take their force, right, Tai Chi, take their force and redirect it. Don't meet force upon force. So follow your training, follow your instincts. Don't be pushy. I would certainly say align yourself with that and then redirect. That's because I wouldn't expect it. Because if you push back, the line's in the sand, and then boom. So here's what it would sound like. Somebody comes to you and says, hey, Dwight, I don't think I should continue anymore. I think I've got it. I would certainly say something like, well, that may be true. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. Let me ask you a couple questions, and now I start. When I say, hey, you know what? That may be true. I'm not disagreeing with you. You can see, right? Posture changes. They thought they were going to get pushback. Now you've aligned yourself. Now you start asking those questions. And then it's almost like in boxing, when the bell goes off, the other person lowers their gloves, and then you keep going. You know, the greatest move in Sandler is when somebody says, hey, I'm perfectly happy. I would say, sounds like it may be over then. Can I just ask you a question or two before I go? They say, sure. And I ask all those consultative questions. So, Dwight, do follow your training. Do what instinctively makes sense. Just agree. Doesn't mean you're going to agree in 10 minutes. Agree with their statement and then realign them. Draw them through why they got there. And as people talk out loud, they'll realize that their decision is flawed. But you would never have got them to talk if you instantly pushed back.
Perfect. Dave, how do I teach my staff to overcome the it costs too much objection, especially when the customer acknowledges that our service is worth every penny?
Well, it costs too much. First of all, they should be having 5x8 cards done. If you were a sales manager, it sounds like you are. That has your top 10 objections, and then come up with, as a team, here are the rock'em sock'em responses. You know, we have a playbook for all the top objections. I think you could do the same. As far as the cost too much, you know, here's where we are. Let's step back, because that's a symptom of a greater problem. Greater problem is you probably haven't tied value into the cost. Now, they may say, oh yeah, it's certainly worth it. That's an intellectual discussion. But if you take people through the pain step, which is, hey, why do they need that? People buy emotionally, justify their decisions intellectually. Pain-based selling is very effective. We've been doing it for years. If somebody says they have an issue, issue A, here's some questions that I would like you to ask. One, well, if somebody says, hey, I'm having a real issue with, let's just say this product's not working, I say, well, tell me more about that. That allows them to start talking. They're getting emotionally involved. Here's my second question. How long has it been a problem? I say, well, it's been a problem for about 5 or 6 years. I say, well, okay, I don't understand. So give me an example. And they start to give you an example. And then I'll say things like, well, what have you done to try to fix this in the past? And again, I'm giving you a bullet form of this conversation. And then the fourth question always is, well, just if you had to guess, I mean, the fact that the product's not working as effectively as you'd like it to be, what do you think that costs in the organization? Then I tie it into something, whether it's lost productivity, competitive nature, whatever the case may be. And let's just hypothetically say, well, I don't know, $25,000, $30,000. Say, what, per quarter, per day? No, it's probably per year. So over the last 5 years, it's cost $115,000, is that right? Yeah. All right, so now you have what the cost of the problem is. If you're coming up with a solution that's $30,000 or $40,000, then it's easy to do. When we do debriefs of sales calls, 9 out of 10 times there was no financial cost attributed to the problem. Yes, they understood the problem. Yes, they agree with the problem. Yes, they even think that you probably could fix the problem. But they also think that I could probably do it without you internally or cheaper somewhere else. You would just go back and ask yourself, did you attribute a financial impact to the problem? Chances are, 9 out of 10 times, you're not going to have a price issue. We're not the cheapest on the market. So we would always hear, if you didn't do a good pain step, wow, that's very expensive. Well, they're saying that because they don't truly understand, A, what the cost is, and B, they don't have the conviction that you can fix it. This is a nice way to push back on an area that 9 out of 10 salespeople don't have the authority to negotiate price, so it tends to be over. But again, I don't think that's the problem, Mike. I think that's the symptom of a missed step. You probably do a good job in the need step. Add one more component. What is it costing the company? And what's it costing the person sitting in front of you? Because if they're losing bonuses or commissions or they're not getting promoted as often as they should be, they'll spend the money.
Great. Dave, what do you feel about information marketing to generate leads in sales? This is the education of a certain topic on a periodic basis and then to turn prospects into qualified leads.
Well, I'm a huge proponent. That is our number one prospecting source with Sandler. You know, as I said earlier, we can get in front of 20 strangers, 13 give us an appointment, 9 buy. So I think that's great. I also think it allows you to be a content expert. You are seen as the expert versus a salesperson. I tend to do 10 things that you need to think about when, and I give them those 10 things. If I never see them again, it adds value to their life. Obviously, the 10 things that I'm saying you need to think about to increase the productivity of, let's say, your sales force are things that I'm good at. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they need me to fulfill the 10 things I'm going to tell them. They could do it on their own. But I am a content expert. When I show up, I'm not a salesperson. I'm a speaker. I'm an expert at my product, at this particular topic, which is how to increase the productivity of your sales force under this example. So I would suggest, hey, keep doing them. There's more and more people that are in that market that do these now, so they're not as glitzy as they once were 3 to 5 years ago. However, the key to these educational seminars is not the seminar. The key to the seminars is the front end to drive people there. You'll always have about a 50% no-show rate. So you got to drive them. You got to make it entertaining, informative, and then close at the end of your seminar. If you try to chase people after the fact, your appointment ratio goes down geometrically. The key at the end of the seminars is to have them say yes or no to an appointment. Don't try to close for money. Don't try to close for business. Close for an appointment. And the yes or no is, hey, yes, you want an appointment. Get people to take out their date timers right there. Get it done. They're not going to whip out the PDA. Give it to you in front of everybody. Yes or no that you're willing to take your phone call and get an appointment. We have found that's the most effective way to increase our close rate. We have been tracking this now for 26 years we've been doing this. We have this thing down to a science.
Dave, what methods would you suggest when positioning to sell a product that has a very long sales cycle or may have multiple channels to go through before a decision can be made? Any tips on how you can position that initial sales process because of the long lag time?
Sure. I mean, that's the world that I live in. So for me, every single call should have a goal and an outcome. So think about what a sales process is. It doesn't matter to me, like, whether it's 1 year, 5 years, or one day. I think sales is nothing more than a series of agreements, a series of action steps. The best way to keep yourself positioned properly within an account is to continue those action steps along the way, because by the time the prospect looks behind them, they're 75% through this sales process, and they've also made a lot of decisions. So start with an upfront contract. Again, what is the goal of the call? Also make a decision about what's going to happen next. You can't make a decision about, hey, yes, they're going to say yes or no to the business, but give them homework, make a a decision about when you're going to meet, what's going to happen afterwards, and track the activity. Always give people something to do. You know, and I would like to meet XYZ person next time that we're here. You've got to go deep and wide. In the long-term selling process, you need a lot of coaches on your side. So meet people and say, hey, based on what you know, would you mind coaching me through this process? They have emotional ownership then. That's a positive. So you want to do that. You also want to make sure that you have a relationship with the organization and not an individual. A problem with long-term selling cycles with salespeople who only latch onto one person, that's a real problem. So you want to have advocates throughout the whole organization. Ask people, would you be my coach? Also, give them action steps, manage the activities, take a little mini steps. You should map out what you want them to do along the way. Don't just show up and wing it, knowing it's a 9-month selling cycle, a year in month one. They have made the decision earlier in the process. They've got to go through the gyrations internally to get that done. Executive briefings internally during a selling process, fantastic idea. If one of the mini steps is to go visit a client together, great. If it's to do a brainstorming session with the key players, great. So you should have key landmarks of what you're going to do. And again, though, meet as many people as you can.
Here's a question from Jeff. Jeff says, we all know that getting sales through referrals can be more powerful than cold calling. If you had to choose between the two, what would you choose and why, and what best strategy would you use for each?
Well, cold calling to referrals, what's the most effective is certainly going to be referrals. You probably have a 7-to-1 ratio on the close rate on a referral than you would on a cold call. It's also 5 times less expensive for any organization to go after referrals than it is cold calls. So Jeff would be saying, well, I don't really care about that. I don't know all the company, but you should care about that because the time that it takes from the initial contact to the close is substantially less on a referral. Now, here's some of the tricks on referrals. Number one, majority of salespeople wait until you're a client to ask for a referral. And then you'll hear something like, well, Jeff, that's great. Yeah, let me try it out for a while. Then if I'm happy with it, I'll give you people. Okay? Your selling cycle also dictates that if you had 30, 40, 50 people in the beginning of the funnel, only one or two pop out the bottom of the funnel. So you're limiting yourself. I always ask for referrals during the selling process in addition to my clients. I have more people in the sales funnel than I do in the back end because it's just a natural attrition of disqualifying prospects throughout the way, whether they're disqualifying me or I'm disqualifying them. So ask up front. You also want to do spheres of influence. You know, so you're asking for the types of people that would be, I'm going to say, powers of influence for them. And so what that means is instead of saying, hey, who else besides yourself do you know may be able to use our product or service? And everyone hears, well, I don't know. When you say to yourself, well, how can you not know for crying out loud? You know people. So I tend to say, you know, if it were me, I'd say, hey, Jeff, let's pretend it was Friday afternoon. You had a business question, but you couldn't ask anybody within your own department. You had to call somebody. Give me 3 people's names that you would call. First names only. I'd call Mike, Steve, Ed. Okay, well, let me ask you a question. You know what I do. You know the types of problems that I solve. You know, hypothetically, Jeff, if you were me, which one of those people would you call first just to kind of give an overview of what I did? And then all of a sudden, they'll say, well, I would call Ed. Okay, well, why Ed? Why did he pop into mind? Well, here's the reason why. Then they start to talk to you about all of Ed's problems. And then you ask, I don't suppose you'd be nice enough to call Ed just to let him know who I am and that I may be calling. Now you're going to get an introduction. And that's very strong. So these inner circle relationships, as we call them at Sandler, are very powerful. But narrow it down to 1 or 2. Don't go out with a dragnet of who else besides yourself you think would need my product or service because you tend to get a nothing response. Here's the other thing. For any of the one that's listening, if you are convinced, and hopefully you are, that referrals are better than cold calls, then you should have a goal for yourself every month. How many referrals am I getting? Don't be passive on this. Passive meaning if I service my customers properly, they will call with referrals. That is a farce. That doesn't happen that way. That doesn't mean that they're not appreciative, but certainly the amount of people that will call you versus you proactively doing it is night and day. I have a goal. I want 5 a week, so I'm going to be proactively asking everybody, and if it's now Wednesday, Thursday, and I have 2, boy, I'll tell you what, I kick it up because by Friday afternoon, I would like 5 referrals. So set a goal for yourself and then track the goal because I think that you'll be more proactive in it, but your results will go through the roof because, again, your closing ratio is substantially higher.
Here's a question from Jim Peet. He's the CEO and owner of MySuccessGateway.com, which is a wonderful website. He's got a bunch of fascinating interviews on there. And he asks, what is the state of the sales training and personal development industries today? And where do you see their future heading?
Well, the state of personal development and sales and management training is about a $210 billion market. So people certainly want to be more productive, whether it's to position themselves better within an organization, whether they're driven by higher commissions. But inherently, people want to do a good job. So I think the market is fine. I have found over the last 25 years when the market is difficult out there, we've got layoffs, we have inflation, actually our business goes up. That's counterintuitive, but here's what I have found. When times are great, people throw money at training and coaching and self-development. Managers will throw it at employees. Hey, we brought in a motivational speaker, we brought in a sales training course. In parentheses, they say, to show you we love you. When times are tough, half the sales force has been let go. The other half of the sales force, of course, there's no memo, Mike, that says, hey, quota's gone down. Implicit that, we've let some of the salespeople go. And by the way, you've got to make up their numbers. They don't say it out loud, but that's really true. How are we going to get that done? And then there is a real commitment to training and personal development when they know they've got to step up to the plate to get that increased productivity down. So when the market's tough, we actually do a lot better. As far as the future is concerned, I think online learning has fallen flat on its face in most of these, what I'm going to say, soft skills training, whether it's sales training, management training. Certainly for product training, online learning is awesome. What we have found is that companies have shied away from that. They're going initially to facilitator-led training.
Why do you think the online learning has not worked?
Because there's no interaction. There's no feedback. Let's face it, you can't just watch a video or listen to a CD and say, oh, I got it. You know, humans actually will do it by imitation and observation. So if somebody says, well, here's how you get past the gatekeeper, most salespeople want to know, well, wait a minute now, what about this? Or how do I do that? Or how do I do this? Even our dialogue today, like, you know, people are asking implementation questions. And I think they want to get immediate feedback. They also want the opportunity to say, well, wait a minute now, let me play prospect. And I love that. I always let people at our seminars play prospect, and I'll play them as a salesperson to show them how to use it. Now, online learning, I think it's got its place. The place, in my estimation, is reinforcement. I think if they've heard it, they have the opportunity to have dialogue with the trainer, then I think reinforcement, it's great to replace a facilitator to say, you know, here's how you motivate your sales force, or here's how you do a coaching. It's very difficult. So I think a blended approach is the way to go versus what the industry tried to do 5 to 6 years ago, which is to really get rid of the facilitator-led training, to 100% technology. And I think the organizations as a whole have found that even with the websites, how many companies do we know, Mike, in the marketing world that have tried to do 100% marketing through their websites many, many years ago and realized that, hey, that's just a tool in the quiver, but not 100%. There's a lot of other things you need to do out there, and I think that's true with learning also.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. I agree. I think people want that coach. They want someone by their side, you know, real person face to face. And this is what separates Sandler from almost all the other sales training companies out there. Is this Sandler's USP?
Absolutely. I mean, Sandler is a big believer in ongoing reinforcement training. I mean, that's our claim to fame. We have 220 training centers so people can come and get, yes, theory, but equally as important, how to get it done. You know, I used to, which I still do, I'll go into a corporation and say, if you don't get a 20% increase in productivity, sales, don't pay me. Matter of fact, I'll refund your money. They'll say, well, how do you do that? I said, well, you know what it is? Yes, I think Sandler's got great material. It's reinforcement. We've got to keep the process going so it doesn't become end is to shall pass. That's the key. And I think they also want to hear from somebody that they know has been there before. You don't need a trainer telling you what to do that's never done it on their own. So that is really important. So I think from reinforcement and credibility is the winning combination. But you're right. That's what Sandler's known for, and that's how we get the results in the marketplace that we do.
Does Sandler offer a business opportunity for sales managers or people in sales like you were when you first found out about it?
We have franchise franchise our concept. So right now we have franchises throughout the world, certainly North America, and we have in most major metropolitan areas, we've got franchises for every about a 500,000 people, and they're all ex-salespeople or ex-managers. And I have found that it's easier to take a manager and a salesperson who's passionate about what they do and turn them into a great trainer versus a trainer teaching them the sales management skills. You can never transfer that to their clients if they never succeed, so we don't take them.
How many franchises do you have here in the U.S.?
The U.S., we're, I think, about 180 franchises here in the U.S. Very successful. There's a couple of states that we're not in, but for the most part, we're in everybody's backyard, both huge metropolitan areas like the L.A.s of the world.
I'm sure you have probably a world-class selling system for the franchisees to sell sales training. Okay, so let's say someone is interested in investing in a franchise. What kind of training and assistance are they going to get from the home office in building that franchise?
We take them cradle to grave. We assume that you've had some selling abilities, but we also make the assumption, Mike, that you haven't been selling for a little while and you know nobody in your backyard. So we take you from, hey, listen, we're a franchise company. That is sales training. So we've really combined the two. We have a 4% failure rate or a 96% success rate. Now, any sales manager out there would kill for that. I mean, that is an awesome statistic. And if you've ever looked at a franchise, you would realize that that is just unbelievable, especially in a service industry. 4% don't make it, which means 96% do. Why? Well, all the marketing stuff is done. We give them all the leader's guides. We talk to each of our trainers twice a day. We pre-brief the day. We debrief the day. We have leader's guides. Everything is follow the bouncy ball, but allows them to put in their own personalities, which makes them flourish. So we have really got that down to a science because we train end users. So if you think about it, we have a double-edged sword. We're going to train the end user on the Sandler selling system, but we're also training our franchisees on how to start a business, how to maintain that business, the marketing stuff, the sales training portion of it. There's a lot of balls in the air that they have to become proficient in very, very quickly. So we take what we did to the marketplace and applied it on ourselves. You know the old saying, you know, the cobbler's kids have no shoes. We cannot afford to do that in our industry. So we transform within 3 to 4 months. And that's the ramp-up time. We transform people who have done it probably informally at their organization to literally absolute training and sales machines.
When you say success rate, what are the qualifications for you to deem the franchise a success?
For us, the success is based on market and revenue. Let's face it, in our world, a bad coach or a bad sales trainer is not going to have any clients. If I call in an entrepreneur, and let's say, Mike, that you had 25 salespeople, you're going to look at me saying, hey, do I want Dave to teach my people? Is this who I want them to emulate? Because, yes, Sandler has great material, but if you don't connect with the person in front of you, I got a real problem. So how we view it is, how many clients do you have? The revenues that you're generating, because the ripple effect of that means is that, hey, you're helping companies grow because you're going to get referrals. We need 20 clients. Once you have 20 clients, we are 100% referral generated. And that is very impressive. The only reason that happens is because the results that we give our end users go through the roof. But we measure success based on revenue and you're staying. Stay in the business. We put a way for us to measure that. There's only two franchises in the United States that do not have a royalty base. All right, we have a flat fee. So if you generate $3 million in business or you generate $30,000 in business, you're sending us the same amount of money. Now, that seems insane from a business perspective, but it's done a lot of things. It's kept people in the business because they're not paying high royalties once they understand the intellectual property. There's no reason to leave. But it also gets rid of the people, Mike, who shouldn't have been there. Because you could stay on a royalty-based program for 38 years and really send no royalties in because you've generated no money. But you're not going to send us in a flat fee every year unless you're generating money. And that's how we do it.
Is it a monthly flat fee?
It's a monthly flat fee.
And then a one-time investment?
It's a one-time investment. You buy all your products from us and it's a monthly fee.
Are you the person in charge of dealing with all the franchisees?
I help train the franchisees. Ron Taylor talks to prospective franchisees, and Steve Howell manages a team of coaches who really make sure that the success of the franchisee is exactly what they want it to be.
If someone was interested in investigating more about your franchise opportunity, what would be the best number to call and who to talk to?
Well, you could go to www.sandler.com, and there's a whole section there for business opportunity. Or you could call Ron Taylor, who's been with us for 22 years, and Ron's phone number is 1-800-638-5686. And you can either have the secretary put you through, or his extension is 2033.
Perfect. Hey, Dave, this has been great. That's the end of our question and answer session with Dave Mattson of Sandler Sales Institute. I hope this has been helpful. I hope it's given you some confidence to go out there and get that next deal. I hope it's given you the ability to get more referrals, to prospect easier, and to have a different attitude about selling. Thanks for listening. Did you know I do audio interviews? I bet you could tell by now that I do audio interviews with experts on marketing, advertising, direct mail, list management, you name it. My interviews can build the value of your information products. My interviews can enhance the sales of a website. My interviews can make you famous. If you want someone who has an intimate knowledge of the direct mail business and understands the questions to ask, understands how to dig out the scoop, understands how to produce, develop, and create a compelling audio product, you want to talk to me. I promise you, if you've got a product you're selling and you want to bring life and build value into it, please contact me. It's Michael with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. And another bonus tip, how would you like to turn your $28 book or ebook or even a concept in your head into a $3,900 information product? I'll provide you the secrets on how to do this. If you'd like a completely free 30-day trial of my system for turning your simple book or even just a concept in your mind into an information product that you can sell for $97, $197, or even as much as $3,900 or more, this system includes a whole range of tricks and tips to help you pack your audio program full of great stories that take control of your listeners' brains. My information product creation system comes with my personal guarantee that you'll create an information product worth from $97 to $497 that's designed to sell like hotcakes. This is a 30-day free trial. If you'd like information on this, please email me at michael@hardtofindseminars.com. In the subject line, write in all caps, $28 book, and I'll email you information on how to turn your $28 book or even a concept in your mind into a $3,900 information product. Hi, this is Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Here is another bonus tip and a valuable service that I offer to select clients. If you can talk into an ordinary telephone, you can be selling your own high-priced audio programs in as little as 7 days. This is the easiest way on earth to create a series of powerful audio recordings for your own information product. I call you on an ordinary telephone and interview you live on a series of related hot topics about your niche subject. I take care of all the editing, all the technical stuff, and I give you the finished MP3s or WAV files and audio transcripts. I only have time to give this deluxe personalized service to a few more carefully selected clients. If you're interested in developing and creating your own valuable information products that you could have complete in as short as 7 days and be selling for as high as $300, $500, even $3,900, please contact me at michael@hardtofindseminars.com. In the subject line of your email, please write info product information in all capital. Make sure I have your name and a way to contact you by phone and we can talk about your specific ideas. Or you may call me at 858-274-7851. Hi, it's Michael Senoff here with another bonus tip from Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. It's called an audio infomercial. Your audio infomercial, which I create for you, will sell more products of yours faster, easier, and for less cost than any conventional advertising method, and I guarantee it 100%. Imagine catching yourself at concert pitch talking about what makes your business or your product service unique, what makes it special. Imagine imagine taking a professional recording of that perfect sales presentation that I create for you and giving it to your prospect as an audio CD or an internet download from your website. I can do this for you faster than you ever thought possible with my personalized audio informational recording service. If you're interested in this unique service, please contact me at michael@hardtofindseminars.com. In the subject line of your email, in all capitals, write audio infomercial, and I will get back with you with more information. Hi, it's Michael Sinoff here with another tip from Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. This tip is one that is dear to my heart, and the reason why is because I know what a difference it can make for your business. It has to do with editing your audio recordings. If you are using audio online or offline to sell, market, and educate your prospects, this tip will be the most important tip you ever hear from me. Editing your audio content before you publish it to your site simply gets better results compared to unedited audio content. Think about this. A new song on the radio may be in the editing studio for months before it's released to the public. A new movie may take years in the editing process before it's released to the big screen or on DVD. Well-written sales letters, online promotions, books, and commercials are all meticulously edited to perfection before they are released. You would never dream of releasing an unedited version of any of these sales vehicles. So why would you publish unedited audio? Unedited audio content is abandoned by the listener faster, it produces less sales for you, and it actually destroys your credibility as a publisher. So why are we seeing so much unedited content proliferating the internet? The reason is simple. There are very few people who offer audio editing services who know what they are doing. Editing audio is kind of like plastic surgery. It's part skill and part an art form. You need someone with both the skill to do it and someone who understands marketing and selling. A poor result can be gained by both a skilled surgeon as well as a good technical editor. Who you choose to do your audio editing can be one of the best investments in your business. At HardToFindSeminars.com, we have been editing online and offline web content for 6 years. We have perfected a proprietary editing system that has been proven to get your customers to listen to your audio content longer and to listen to it more often, resulting in more sales for you more often, and with clean edited audio, you can demand more money for your products and services. It's just like in life, you only have one chance to make a first impression. Every time you release and publish unedited audio content, you are projecting a poor, sloppy, I don't care attitude that turns your prospects off. Do your prospects a favor. Service them. Give them your best. Do them a favor by giving them professionally edited audio messages, interviews, teleseminars, and selling promotions by editing your audio. We provide full audio editing services that are fast and at a reasonable rate. We know that editing your audio content can easily pay for itself 20 times over. Call me, Michael Sinoff, for more information at 858-274-7851. I'll spend some time on the phone with you. We'll determine what audio content you're publishing. I'll be glad to offer you a free consultation on my ideas. I'll review some of your audio, and together we'll come up with a solution that gets you better results. Thanks for listening.